and banishing Thomas Edison and his light bulbs from mind. Saul Goodman looks back over the first 8 memos briefly, using the conservative and logical side of his personality, rigidly holding back the intuitive functions. It was a habitual exercise with him, and he called it expansion and contraction, leaping in the dark for the connection that must exist between fact one and fact two, then going back slowly to check on himself. The names and phrases flow past in review. Fra Dolcino, 1508, Roshinaya, Hassani Sabah, 1090, Weishaupt, assassinations, John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Major Daley, Cecil Rhodes, 1888, George Washington. Choices. 1. It is all true, exactly as the memo suggests. 2. It is partly true and partly false. 3. It is all false, and there is no secret society that has endured from 1090 AD to the present. Well, it isn't all true. Mayor Daley never said Aviger Blumenkraft to Senator Ribicoff. Saul had read in the Washington Post a lip reader's translation of Daley's diatribe, and there was no German in it, although there was obscenity and anti-Semitism. The Weishaupt Washington impersonation theory also had some flaws. In those days, before plastic surgery, such an undetected assumption of the identity of a well-known figure was especially hard to credit, despite the circumstantial evidence quoted in the memos. 2 strong arguments against choice 1. The memos are not all true. How about choice 3? The Illuminati might not be a straight, unbroken line from the first recruit gathered by old Hassani Sabah to the person who bombed Confrontation. It might have died and lain dormant for a term, like the Ku Klux Klan between 1872 and 1915. And it might have gone through such breakups and resurrections more than once in 8 centuries. But linkages of some sort, however tenuous, reached from the 11th century to the 20th, from the Near East to Europe and from Europe to America. Saul's dissatisfaction with official explanations of recent assassinations, the impossibility of making any rational sense out of current American foreign policy, and the fact that even historians who vehemently distrusted all conspiracy theories acknowledged the pivotal role of secret Masonic lodges in the French Revolution. All these added weight to the rejection of choice 3. Besides, the Masons were the first group, according to at least 2 of the memos, infiltrated by Weishaupt. Choice 1 is definitely out, then. And choice 3 almost certainly equally invalid. Choice 2, therefore, is most probably correct. The theory in the memos is partly true and partly false. But what, in essence, is the theory? And which part of it is true? Which part false? Saul lit his pipe, closed his eyes, and concentrated. The theory, in essence, was that the Illuminati recruited people through various fronts, turned them onto some sort of illuminizing experience through marijuana, or some special extract of marijuana, and converted them into fanatics willing to use any means necessary to illuminize the rest of the world. Their aim, obviously, is nothing less than the total transformation of humanity itself, along the lines suggested by the film 2001, or by Nietzsche's concept of the Superman. In the course of this conspiracy, the Illuminati, according to Malik's hints to Jackson, were systematically assassinating every popular political figure who might interfere with their program. Saul thought suddenly of Charlie Manson, and of the glorification of Manson by the weatherman and Morituri bombers. And he thought of the popularity of pot-smoking and of the slogan, "By any means necessary," with contemporary radical youth even outside weatherman. And he thought of Nietzsche's slogans, "Be hard. Whatever is done for love is beyond good and evil. Above the ape is man, and above man the Superman. Forget not thy whip." In spite of his own logic, which had proved that Malick's theory was only partly true, Saul Goodman, a lifelong liberal, suddenly felt a pang of typically right-wing terror toward modern youth. He reminded himself that Malick seemed to think the conspiracy emanated chiefly from Mad Dog. And that was God's lightning country down there. God's lightning had no fondness for marijuana or for youth or for the definitely anti-Christian overtones of the Illuminati philosophy. Besides, Malick's sources were only partly trustworthy, and there were other possibilities. The Shriners, for instance, were part of the Masonic movement, were generally right-wing, had their own hidden rites and secrets, and used Arabic trappings that might well derive from Hassani Sabah or the Roshinaya of Afghanistan. Who could say what secret plots were hatched at Shriner conventions? Nah, that was the intuitive pole vaulter in the right lobe at work again. And right now, Saul was concerned with the plodding logician in the left lobe. The key to the mystery was in getting a clearer definition of the purpose of the Illuminati. Identify the change they were trying to accomplish in man and in his society, and then you would be able to guess, at least approximately, who they were. Their aim was English domination of the world, and they were Rhodes Scholars, according to the Birchers. That idea obviously belonged with Saul's own whimsy about a worldwide Shriner conspiracy. What then? The Italian Illuminati under Fra Dolcino wanted to redistribute the wealth, but the international bankers mentioned in the Playboy letter presumably wanted to hold on to their wealth. Weishaupt was a free thinker, according to the Britannica, and so were Washington and Jefferson. But Sabah and Joachim of Florence were evidently heretical mystics of the Islamic and Catholic traditions, respectively. Saul picked up the ninth memo, deciding to get more facts, or pretended facts, before analysing further. And then it hit him. Whatever the Illuminati were aiming at had not been accomplished. Proof, if it had, they would not still be conspiring in secret. Since almost everything has been tried in the course of human history, find out what hasn't been tried, at least not on a large scale, and that will be the condition to which the Illuminati are trying to move the rest of mankind. Capitalism had been tried. Communism had been tried. Even Henry George's single tax has been tried in Australia. Fascism, feudalism, mysticism have been tried. Anarchism has never been tried. Anarchism was frequently associated with assassinations. It had an appeal for free thinkers such as Kropotkin and Bakunin, but also for religious idealists like Tolstoy and Dorothy Day of the Catholic Worker Movement. Most anarchists hoped Joachim-like to redistribute the wealth. But Rebecca had once told him about a classic of anarchist literature, Max Stirner's The Ego and His Own, which had been called The Billionaire's Bible, because it stressed the advantages the rugged individualist would gain in a stateless society. And Cecil Rhodes was an adventurer before he was a banker. The Illuminati were anarchists. It all fit. The pieces of the puzzle slipped together smoothly. Saul was convinced. He was also wrong.
We just get our troops over Fernando Po,
the chairman of the Chinese Communist Party said on April the 1st.
A place that size isn't worth world war. But we don't have any troops there.
An aide told him.
It is the Russians who do. Oh.
The chairman quoted a proverb to the effect that there was urine in the rose water.
I wonder what the hell the Russians want with Fernando Po,
he added thoughtfully. He was harassed, but still he spoke with authority. He was, in fact, characteristic of the best type of dominant male in the world at this time. He was 55 years old, tough, shrewd, unburdened by the complicated ethical ambiguities which puzzle intellectuals, and had long ago decided that the rest of the world was a mean son of a bitch, in which only the most cunning and ruthless can survive. He was also as kind as was possible for one holding that ultra-Darwinian philosophy. And he genuinely loved children and dogs, unless they were on the site of something that had to be bombed in the national interest. He still retained some sense of humour, despite the burdens of his almost godly office. And although he had been impotent with his wife for nearly 10 years now, he generally achieved orgasm in the mouth of a skilled prostitute within 1.5 minutes. He took amphetamine PET pills to keep going on his grueling 20-hour day, with the result that his vision of the world was somewhat skewed in a paranoid direction, and he took tranquilizers to keep from worrying too much, with the result that his detachment sometimes bordered on the schizophrenic. But most of the time, his innate shrewdness gave him a fingernail grip on reality. In short, he was much like the rulers of America and Russia.
And it's not only a sin against God,
Mr. Mossenego shouts,
but it gives you germs, too.
It is 1950, early spring on Mulberry Street, and young Charlie Mossenego raises terrified eyes.
Look, look,
Mr. Mossenego goes on angrily.
Don't believe your own father? See what the dictionary says. Look, look at the page. Here, see. Masturbation. Self-pollution. Do you know what self-pollution means? Do you know how long those germs last?
And in another spring, 1955, Charles Mossenego, a pale, skinny, introverted genius, registers for his first semester at MIT. And coming to the square on the form that says religion, writes in careful block capitals, atheist. He has read Kinsey and Hirschfeld and almost all the biologically oriented sexological treatises by this time, studiously ignoring psychoanalysts and such unscientific types. And the only visible remnant of that early adolescent terror is a habit of washing his hands frequently when under tension, which earns him the nickname Soapy. General Talbot looks at Mossenego pityingly and raises his pistol to the scientist's head. On August the 6th, 1902, the world produced its usual crop of new humans, all programmed to act more or less alike, all containing minor variations of the same basic DNA blueprint. Of these, approximately 51,000 were female and 50,000 were male. And two of the males, born at the same second, were to play a large role in our story, and to pursue somewhat similar and anabatic careers. The first, born over a cheap livery stable in the Bronx, New York, was named Arthur Flagenheimer, and at the other end of his life spoke very movingly about his mother, as well as about bears and sidewalks and French-Canadian bean soup. The second, born in one of the finest old homes on Beacon Hill in Boston, was named Robert Putney Drake, and at the other end of his life, thought rather harshly of his mother. But when the paths of Mr. Flagenheimer and Mr. Drake crossed in 1935, one of the links was formed which led to the Fernando Po incident. And in the present time, more or less, 00005 was summoned to meet W in the headquarters of a certain branch of British intelligence. The date was March the 17th, but being English, neither 00005 nor W gave a thought to Blessed St. Patrick. Instead, they spoke of Fernando Pooh.
The Yanks,
W said crisply,
are developing evidence that the Russians or the Chinese or both of them are behind this tequila immoto swine. Of course, even if that were true, it wouldn't matter a damn to Her Majesty's government. What do we care if a speck of an island that size turns red? But you know the Yanks, 00005. They're ready to go to war over it, although they haven't announced that publicly yet.
My mission,
00005 asked. The fault lines of cruelty about his mouth turning into a most engaging smile.
Is to hop down to Fernando Poo and find out the real politics of this tequila immortal bloke. And if he is red, overthrow him before the Yanks blow up the world.
That's the assignment. We can't have a bloody nuclear war just when the balance of payments is almost straightened out and the common market is finally starting to work. So, hop to it straight away. Naturally, if you're captured, Her Majesty's government will have to disavow any knowledge of your actions.
It always seems to work out that way,
00005 said ironically.
I wish for once you'd give me a mission where Her Majesty's bleeding government would stand behind me in a tight spot.
But 00005, of course, was merely being witty. As a loyal subject, he would follow orders under any circumstances, even if it required the death of every soul on Fernando Pooh, and himself as well. He rose in his characteristically debonair fashion and headed for his own office, where he began his preparations for the Fernando Pooh mission. His first step was to check his personal worldwide travel notebook, seeking the bar in Santa Isabel, which came closest to serving a suitable martini, and the restaurant most likely to prepare an endurable lobster Newberg. To his horror, there was no such bar and no such restaurant. Santa Isabel was bereft of social graces.
I say,
00005 muttered,
this is going to be a bit thick.
But he cheered up quickly, for he knew that Fernando Pooh would be equipped at least with a bevy of tawny-skinned or coffee-coloured females, and such women were the holy grail to him. Besides, he had already formed his own theory about Fernando Pooh. He was convinced that bugger, blowhards, unreformed gangsters, goons and espionage renegades, an international conspiracy of criminals and double agents, led by the infamous and mysterious Eric the Red Blowhard, was behind it all. 00005 had never heard of the Illuminati. In fact, 00005, despite his dark hair, combed straight back, his piercing eyes, his cruel and handsome face, his trim athlete's body, and his capacity to penetrate any number of females and defenestrate any number of males in the course of duty, was not really an ideal intelligence agent. He had grown up reading Ian Fleming novels, and one day, at the age of 21, looked in the mirror, decided he was everything a Fleming hero should be, and started a campaign to get into the spy game. After 14 years in bureaucratic burrowing, he finally arrived in one of the intelligence services, but it was much more the kind of squalid and bumbling organization in which Harry Palmer had toiled his cynical days away than it was a berth of bondage. Nevertheless, 00005 did his best to refurbish and glamorize the scene and, perhaps because God looks after fools, he hadn't managed to get himself killed in any of the increasingly bizarre missions to which he was assigned. The missions were all weird at first because nobody took them seriously. They were all based on wild rumors that had to be checked out just in case there'd be some truth in them. But later, it was realized that 00005's peculiar schizophrenia was well suited to certain real problems, just as the schizoid of the more withdrawn type is ideal for a sleeper agent, since he could easily forget what was conventionally considered his real self. Of course, nobody at any time ever took Bugger seriously, and behind his back, 0005's obsession with this organisation was a subject of much interdepartmental humour.
Wonderful as it was,
Mary Lou said.
Some of it was scary. Why?
Simon asked.
All those hallucinations, I thought I might be losing my mind.
Simon lit another joint and passed it over to her.
What makes you think, even now, that it was just hallucinations?
He asked. Rock, 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 till broad daylight.
If that was real,
Mary Lou said firmly,
everything else in my life has been a hallucination.
Simon grinned.
Now,
he said calmly,
you're getting the point.